This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. 2018 is the 50th anniversary year of Reason, and I'm talking to all living editors-in-chief of Reason, former and current, and that brings me today to Catherine Mangu Ward, who has worked much of her professional career at Reason, although not exclusively. I'm going to be talking to her today about how she came to Reason Magazine, what role it played in her economic, intellectual, and professional development, and where she sees it heading in its next 50 years. Catherine, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
So let's start at the beginning. You were an intern for Reason Magazine in, was it 2000?
That's right, the summer of 2000.
Okay. So how did that job come to be?
So I sort of finagled my way into that job, actually. I had applied to the Koch Summer Fellowship Program, as it was then known. And the deal was that you kind of got housing and some classes, but that then they placed you in internships. And I saw that Reason Magazine was listed, and you know, word on the street was that that was the best gig in the pool. And so I thought, okay, well, how can I get this? How can I get this job? And I searched, you know, at the time, I think I probably used altavista.digital.com to search the interwebs for some intel about Reason. And I knew from being a reader that the Washington correspondent at the time was Mike Lynch. And so I found out that his wife was a professor at Yale. And I basically stalked him through New Haven. Like, I can't remember exactly how I ended up finding him. Maybe I emailed him or I emailed his wife even. But I it somehow resulted in us having lunch in Maury's, which is this like very, you know, silver goblet old boys club type place where they serve you like pickles and little squares of cheese, like on every table kind of deal. And had to sit down with Mike Lynch and like, you know, to me, it was like, I have to really show him that I'm going to be the best intern he's ever had. Looking back, like the fact that I had already bothered to do any of this, like clearly was going to get me the gig. But I didn't know at the time. Yeah. And Mike tested my fitness for working for him with this test. He drew a bell curve on a napkin and he said, you know, and then he drew a sort of skinnier bell curve, a skinnier bell curve in the middle and said, well, you know, men are on the far end of this bell curve. They're the geniuses and the criminals and women are in the middle. Agree or disagree?
And I was like, how did you answer that?
I was like, yeah, that sounds about right to me, I guess. You know, sort of, again, not understanding what exactly what controversies I was stepping into there. So it was clearly just a quick test to make sure that I wasn't, you know, a secret liberal spy or something. And then I was off and running.
How did you encounter Reason first to know about it?
So I am absolutely a product of the libertarian industrial complex, which having listened to your other podcasts with the previous Reason editors, I was struck by how many of the people that you talk to really, and I think you do as well, to some extent, define themselves as being underdogs in an underdog movement or outsiders in an outsider publication. And I absolutely don't, right? Like I think just because there was such a thing as the libertarian industrial complex by the time I was coming up, which wasn't a luxury that, you know, Virginia Postrel had available to her. So I was the editor of a campus publication that was funded by Collegiate Network, which was in turn part of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. I went to conferences and, you know, received mailings from those outfits as well as the Institute for Humane Studies. My school had visiting speakers that were sometimes even sponsored by these groups. And as part of my membership in the Collegiate Network, I received a Reason Magazine subscription. It was actually in the box that belonged to the Yale Free Press, which was the alternative paper I edited. So I think I probably first encountered when it like fell out of the mailbox because it was a physical mailbox in a wall of mailboxes. And our box was the top row. So the mail always sort of fell on my head. So I suspect I was like literally struck on the head by Reason Magazine in my first encounter.
Do you have any memory of like the early issues that you read? What was on the cover, or what was the first story that kind of made you stand up and say like, wow, this is not just a free magazine, but it's a free magazine worth reading?
I mean, it certainly stood out. The physical object stood out as a higher quality publication than everything else that was coming to me, right? I was getting other student publications, and I was getting, you know, I think Liberty Magazine might have been in there and some others. But it was just very clear that Reason was doing something different and that it was in a kind of a higher, glossier, more mainstream class than these other publications. So I don't remember a specific story. I do remember I loved the brickbats, which is something that all of our readers say, and which I, frankly, I have mixed feelings about brickbats these days. But I absolutely remember sitting at my desk in college, flipping open the magazine to the brickbats to read them first.
Yeah. And the brickbats are short kind of news of the weird from a libertarian filter.
Yeah, specifically news of people around the country and around the world abusing power. I mean, that's how I've always seen them. They're stories of sort of bad cops and bad principals and bad administrators making people's lives a little bit worse, one indignity at a time.
You wrote one piece, or co-authored a piece, I guess, with Mike Lynch that summer when you were an intern, which I remember because I still pull it out every once in a while, which was about how little seniors on Medicare actually spend on prescription drugs. And this was in 2000, both candidates in the 2000 presidential race, George Bush and Al Gore, whose memory is fading, I think, not just from my mind, but that of all Americans. But both had promised to deliver some kind of Medicare prescription drug benefit to elderly people. And can I ask you if you remember, I think I do, but you know, what did it turn out that seniors were actually paying out of pocket for, you know, for prescription drugs?
You know, I should look up that piece. I don't remember any of the numbers. What I do remember is that not only was the finding that the sort of raw figures for prescription drug spending were not that much higher for elderly people and also not that significant of a percentage of their income. But my big takeaway from that piece was like, oh, my God, old people are so rich, which I think is something that our political rhetoric doesn't have space for, or that we are sort of pretending isn't true. Part of that, I think, is a conflation that exists in a lot of debates about welfare between income and assets, right? So older people do often have low income, but they have significant, much more significant assets compared to the rest of the population.
They're living on their pensions, which aren't included as income for the most part. Yeah, I think it was something like 1 or 2, maybe 3% of their annual income was spent on prescription drugs. And the piece that you were involved in pointed out that, you know, they spent more on going out to eat, like eating meals outside of the house in a given year, et cetera, than prescription drugs. And that, you know, I mean, I was working at the magazine. I guess I was the editor of the magazine at that point. But it totally, exploded my mind, blew my mind, because you know, both candidates were talking about we need a prescription drug benefit for Medicare beneficiaries because many of them are choosing between literally, Al Gore said this, between like dog food and, you know, the pills that will control their blood pressure. And even said that his mother had to make choices, which was strange to me. But I was like, God, this is like incredible. And that rhetoric, of course, didn't stop when Bush was successful in pushing Medicare Part D, which covered prescription drugs for seniors, basically regardless of income. And it hasn't stopped since. Do you find that that kind of unreality where, you know, we're talking about stuff as if, you know, seniors are poor in the way that they might have been during the Great Depression, or we talk about you know, street crime as if it's 1978 rather than 2018. Do you find that happens a lot? And is that one of the kind of signature moves of Reason to say, you know what, actually, children aren't being kidnapped at, you know, astronomical rates, even though we think that seems to be the conventional wisdom?
Absolutely. And this is something you and I have talked about extensively, which is, you know, the temptation is to point out the bad math and then kind of, you know, wash your hands of it. And, you know, to me, one of the big challenges of making these sort of arguments and highlighting that kind of information, which Reason does all the time, right, which Elizabeth Nolan Brown, like, just wakes up in the morning and seems to, like, instinctively, you know, put, like, reach out and find a terrible study that's easily debunked. But I think, you know, a lot of what I think about as an editor is, okay, first, find the thing to debunk, do the math. But then second, how do you overcome the narrative? How do you overcome the sort of very, very strong confirmation bias that kicks in on stuff that's, you know, has a big political overlay already in place? But this is, you know, this is Christian Britschke's work on straws and whether or not, in fact, Americans use 500 million straws a day. This is Elizabeth Nolan Brown's work on the extensiveness, the extent of sex trafficking. This is, you know, Lenore Skenazy's work on the frequency of kidnappings and sexual abuse of children. I mean, I just think, you know, we can do this type of thing all over the place. But that's only part of the work. And the other part of the work is figuring out how to say it in a way that's like, you know what? You were wrong about this. You were wrong for good reasons. But now that you know the truth, you gotta adjust your worldview. Come on over.
I guess, you know, a recent story that I think illustrates this, this two-step move you're talking about pretty well is Jacob Sullum's recent cover story about what are the actual roots of the opioid epidemic, and then what do we do about it? And there, the mistake is that people make is the idea that somehow the opioid epidemic is the result of a lot of pain patients becoming junkies, or people getting fake prescriptions and using prescription drugs in order to kind of have a substance abuse problem. He explains why that's not true. And then what is the kind of larger solution or point that he makes that has policy implications?
So there are a couple things that he takes away from, you know, first he digs into the numbers and he finds that, you know, not only are, and I actually don't, this is one of those, I don't really know how to pronounce it, words, iatrogenic.
Iatrogenic,
addiction, which is, you know, addiction that originates in a legitimate medical prescription, that's a very small percentage of the people who eventually constitute the overdose statistics. But then it's a two-step, because it's also that the overdose statistics are very often multi-drug poisoning or adulterated drug poisoning statistics, but that those in turn are incredibly difficult to disaggregate from purposeful drug mixing, right? Like, it's, you know, sometimes you take a speedball on purpose. Sometimes your speedball has fentanyl in it, not on purpose. Sometimes your heroin has fentanyl in it on purpose because, you know, fentanyl's a hell of a drug.
It's a value drug, yeah.
How do you even begin to think about how to deal with this problem when all of that is going on and Chris Christie is just still out there saying sometimes you sprain your ankle and the next thing you know, you're dead in a parking lot with a needle in your arm, which is not the true story. And it's a powerful story that people believe.
I think it's safe to say that it's probably been years since Chris Christie felt his ankles or even saw them. But having you, when we talked about doing this podcast, Catherine, for Reason's 50th anniversary, you said that you noted that you should totally reminisce in more detail about your internship, including the one phone conversation I had with you about Nietzsche that summer. And I'm assuming we're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche. I have no memory of that phone call. What was the phone call about Nietzsche?
It was really about his little-known brother, Harpo Nietzsche, I think. I have a very, very, very clear memory, as I say. At the time, Reason's Washington, D.C. offices were just a spare room in the back of the Institute for Justice's offices on Pennsylvania Avenue, right down by the White House. And I sat at a desk outside the one office that Reason had. So I just sat in, like, a hallway. And But Mike Lynch was often not there. He was sometimes in New Haven. He was sometimes doing things I chose not to inquire about.
He was a tremendously efficient and productive reporter, but he also knew how to disappear without a trace. So.
Right. So obviously that was a great attribute for an intern to have in a boss. But, you know, the other thing that I did that summer was proofread a magazine, and I transcribed like 20,000 hours of an interview with Gary Johnson, which turned out to be prophetic in a variety of ways.
Oh, and that I remember that was Mike's interview with Gary Johnson, called him something like the most dangerous governor in America. And the one detail I remember from that is that at one point, Gary Johnson, like, you know, banged the table and said, you know, there's never a reason to eat more than two slices of pizza at a single time. And I was like, you know, this guy gets it.
He's not wrong.
Yeah.
He's not wrong. So it was like in a sort of a fog of Gary Johnson induced, you know, hallucinations. And I you must have made it your business to like check in on your beleaguered interns at some point, because as I recall, the phone just rang and it was like, hi, this is Nick Gillespie. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Stay cool, Maggie Ward. And then like my memory is that I had this sort of horrible feeling of, you know, I knew that I hadn't really done anything that summer because that's what internships are like. Yeah. But it was my first real internship. So I didn't know that no one expected me to do anything. So I had this sort of super intense rush of imposter syndrome, which was then I was like lulled into complacency by the fact that the conversation we had clearly had no stakes for my employment or anything having to do with reason, and instead was about Nietzsche, which I, in a totally inappropriate and insane move, felt confident talking about at the time because I had just like taken one class, you know, where I had read one book or something. So yeah, we like chatted about Nietzsche a little bit, and you definitely asked me like the same inappropriate questions that you're still asking people on their first day. Like, I think you were like, oh, so abortion, like, should it be legal? And I was like, oh dear God. But I remember at the time that my strong impression was of the idea that reason had these really intellectual, engaged people who were doing the work of journalism, but who weren't like all these other people that I was interning with in Washington, who were kind of in it for the name badge and the byline, so much as being in it for the interesting ideas and sort of feeling like, oh, this is, you know, this is a place I could really belong.
Yeah. And just to close that circuit, which is sparking wires and could start a fire, the inappropriate questions I tend to ask, I believe, are, you know, how do you feel about abortion? What religion were you raised?
And also, what ethnicity is your surname from?
What ethnicity? Yes.
100%.
So these are not, you know, in the current moment, you know.
No,
that,
me too. Yeah. just like a full-fledged, like, Romanian. Interesting. You know, it's like, okay, I guess we're doing that.
When did you start calling yourself a libertarian?
So I was, as we have discussed in other contexts, a teenage objectivist. I read Ayn Rand when I was 15. I was very, very interested in Rand and her ideas. I quickly worked my way through her full catalog as it was available in, you know, all of my local libraries, and thought of myself, to the extent that one can, at 15, as a philosopher, right? Like, I was really into the big ideas, and wasn't too bothered about politics, despite growing up in Washington, D.C. and being surrounded by it, or maybe because of growing up in Washington, D.C.
You grew up
and
in Alexandria, right?
That's right. That's right. And so a Beltway baby.
What was the, you know, what was it about Rand that drew you to her? And I say that as somebody who has never... I was kind of oblivious of libertarianism to a certain degree for a while. And then, you know, Rand never kind of fell in my path. But I'm always interested in what people like about the person who kind of brought them into the fold.
So for me, it was absolutely that, even though I had gotten a very good kind of standard American public education, nobody had talked to me really about economics or ethics or metaphysics. Like, it just wasn't in the world that I was inhabiting. And so I think I experienced what a lot of people experience with Rand, which was the notion of a system, of a way of conceiving of not only, you know, what should I do right now, or even what should I do with my career or in my personal choices, but to see that as part of a larger, you know, a larger way of thinking about the world, and also just in general, right? Like, you know, for a person who likes to think about things, to be told, okay, here are the categories. Because, you know, it was like I read, you know, the Romantic Manifesto, and I was like, oh, aesthetics, interesting, right? Like, it was it was just that she was my introduction to political theory and economics and philosophical thought. So my mother actually gave me a copy of The Fountainhead, to her eternal regret, because my parents were not libertarian, because for her it was a really interesting novel about architecture, and my dad was an architect, so she sort of thought, oh, you know, it's a book about being an artist and about being an architect with vision and values. And she had read it in college, and she, so the story goes, had agreed to go out with my dad, in part because that book had made architects seem sort of sexy and dangerous, which, if you know any architects, you'll know that's not true.
Well, I mean, did your father also have orange hair?
Because he did not. Otherwise, things would start to get a little creepy, I think. But right. So my mom had given me this book, and I had kind of gone all in on it. This was also the early days of the internet. So I like found my way to some objectivist chat rooms, which was, you know, probably set me back socially, but put me forward, you know, into the professional life I enjoy today. But I didn't really become a libertarian or politically interested at all until college, when I joined on my first day of my freshman year, I joined the Objectivist Study Group, which turned out to be a front group. They would actually just meet a couple times. And then once they had drawn in these impressionable freshmen, they would say, you know what, there are other philosophers here, try these. And they would give kids other books to read. And so that was from there, I started reading Hayek, and I met other people who had started out as objectivists or Randians and had sort of moved over to identifying themselves differently, often as libertarians.
So in terms of the, I was going to say toxicology, because I just read a book about
that
Theranos.
That seems fair.
But
that
typology, fair. So you're a libertarian, you're not an objectivist. Are you, do you consider yourself an anarchist or an ANCAP or... you know, a squish, which I think I'm increasingly drawn to the squish faction. But does it make sense to talk about your self-designation within the libertarian movement?
Yeah, I mean, it all feels a little dorm room, but sure. I mean, I would like to say that I was an ANCAP before it was cool. I don't know that sentence it makes any sense, but I definitely read... as an undergrad, a bunch of stuff that sort of took me to, you know, not an ANCAP, you know, not an anarchist from the place of kind of rights theory or legitimacy of the state so much as from a kind of utilitarian and efficiency standpoint. So this idea that anything that you think the state must provide or must provide in order to achieve a certain level of justice or equality or security or, you know,
or just workability of
workability.
Okay.
That instead, you know, there were lots of people out there telling interesting stories about how those things can be and sometimes are provided in the private sector. So, you know, I think of myself as an incrementalist. I think of myself as someone who I'm never a burn it to the ground person. I am never, a revolutionary or a reactionary. I am always looking just for the incremental gain. But the way I judge whether it's a gain or not is to the best of my ability to estimate what the private sector would or could do in the absence of the state. Are we getting closer to something that looks more like that?
You interned at Reason. That was the summer of 2000. And then you went about your way. Where did you go next?
So after that, I graduated. I went to work at the Weekly Standard magazine, mm-hmm. where through really my own ignorance more than strategic calculation, walked in on the first day and said, "Hello, fellow neocons. I'm a libertarian. Nice to meet you," which was in the end great because it avoided the temptation to compromise. I sort of showed up and said, "I want to legalize heroin." And Bill Kristol, to his eternal credit, sort of patted me on the head and said, like, "Fine, great. We'll just put you on fiscal policy stuff. Have fun." I was also the fact checker there, which is a great way to prepare for being an editor, and also a great way to become a better writer. It's also the world's worst job. It's just horrible.
What was the, is there a story that you like to tell about what either was the biggest fact you were like, "There's no fucking way this is true," and it turned out to be totally true, or even more true, or where somebody was just trying to slip by something that was just egregiously made up?
I did catch plagiarism once, which was, it was unfortunately not a sort of exciting, Michael Moynihan, Jonah Lehrer type plagiarism catch so much as it was just a young writer who had been a little over eager in their paraphrasing and lifting of facts from another publication. So like to think I spared the magazine some embarrassment there, at least. Spent a lot of time fact-checking the names of Muslim clerics because this was 2003, 2002. Which spelling of Muhammad is used by whom? I have deep thoughts on that.
And the Mahdi army, how many spellings do they have? Forget about how many divisions does the Pope have, right?
But I was, I was there when, as I jokingly like to say, when Bill Kristol started the Iraq War. So mm-hmm. it was an exciting time to be in that milieu. I was pro-war. And this is something that it's sort of my Norbury, right? Like I do, when I'm sort of feeling cocky and like I know everything, it's good for me to remember that, I had kind of come to this view, which I'm sure was influenced by my social environment, that American liberty and treasure was not more important than the liberty of foreigners, and that it was a sort of, my justification was that it was an overly parochial and insufficiently cosmopolitan view to say that the U.S. armed forces should be used only to defend the national interest, that instead the thing that was important was kind of maximizing global utility, and that meant maximizing freedom. And sure, if we could pop in and liberate a bunch of Iraqis, let's do it.
Yeah, and we had already done it once, right? Within recent
We'd already
memory.
Done it once, so and it was, like, it was like trade wars. They're fun and easy to win whatever. So,
I realize that a lot of people at Reason, and certainly within the libertarian movement, probably give you guff about working at the Weekly Standard, which, I've always found a fascinating magazine. And I remember I think it was the fifth year celebration, or maybe the 10th year anniversary, because it started in the mid-90s, right? Like around 95 or something, I think.
A little earlier, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
So I went to, there must have been the 10th anniversary party in D.C., and I remember congratulating Bill Kristol for, having effectively started pushed two wars, one, American intervention in the Balkans as well as in the Middle East. And I was like, he was like the Florida Marlins. They, winning two World Series in the first 10 years of existence. It seems to me that, what do you see as the main differences between a kind of conservative worldview, particularly that at the Weekly Standard, and a libertarian worldview as articulated by Reason? I'm not looking for you to, to knife somebody or anything here, because it seems like there's a lot of overlap, and then there's a lot of discord. And how do you kind of put these two things together, and where's the overlap, and what are the issues where there's just never going to be any meeting of the minds?
So my political awakening had absolutely come in the context of a kind of 20th century fusionist understanding of American politics, and in particular the American right. So I had this sort of idea influenced by the work of Frank Meyer, mm-hmm. among others, of National Review, that libertarianism and conservatism, particularly a kind of traditionalist conservatism as practiced in the mid-20th century, were highly compatible. And they certainly had been compatible during an era in which the biggest fight in American politics was against communist and socialist.
You were going to say communism, which is the way it used to be pronounced by many people on the right.
So. Yes. So the idea that there was a sort of totalitarian, state-oriented mindset mm-hmm. that was highly focused on equality, and that was the dominant threat to the best things about American politics. That was something that I believed and that I still believe, actually, in many ways, although I think it's changing, and I think it's good that it's changing. Mm-hmm. But because of that tradition that I had come out of, I had a fair amount of experience with building that bridge, with building the bridge to the right, and less with building the bridge to the left. So for me, the thing that was ultimately not compatible with my worldview, and certainly the sort of neoconservatism as it existed at the Weekly Standard, was that those guys were, they were much more utopian than I was comfortable with, right? That there was this idea that you could remake the world in America's image and that we could also impart a certain kind of honor culture is probably an uncharitable way of describing it, but this was a time when Crystal was publishing a lot of Harvey Mansfield's manliness stuff and a lot of Leon Cass and the sort of tragic value of life, a lot of Francis Fukuyama. And, that thread did not sit well with me. And ultimately, it was less the foreign adventurism and more the opposition
bioengineering or biomedical innovation.
Biomedical engineering, but I was gonna try and make it a little broader and say kind of bio-optimism. This idea that we could improve man through technical means, but not through political means. That ultimately sort of pushed me a little bit away, but
yeah, and I can tell you from the other side of that conversation when you were at the Weekly Standard, I was at Reason, and we did an early online debate, which we then reprinted in the magazine in a slightly altered form between Francis Fukuyama and Gregory Stock, who is he was a UCLA biologist who then moved to the Princeton area. And it was, it was about kind of transhumanism in many ways, of whether or not it made sense to try to get rid of mortality, for instance, or to transcend limitations of the human body. And it was genuinely fascinating and heartfelt that somebody like Fukuyama, who had famously declared the end of history and kind of wrote the analysis about what the stakes in the Cold War were, 15 years later, was then denouncing people who wanted to escape the kind of human container, the human form. And that seems like a really strong, difference between the two worldviews.
Yeah. And I will say that my time at the Weekly Standard was such an incredible education in journalism and also in a way of approaching American politics that was deeply principled, right? Like the Weekly Standard was not a Republican Party organ, and they were not bothered by the Republican Party eschewing them. And I think that's very different than a lot of other conservative outlets, particularly at the time.
They were pushing, the Weekly Standard, this was before you were there, but they're insistence that we intervene in the Balkans is a good example.
That's right.
Of that. It was not
they
a
lost,
popular move. Yeah.
They lost a huge percentage of their inaugural subscribers by mm-hmm. supporting that, by supporting the U.S.'s role in that conflict, which I think is fascinating. And, also the sort of camaraderie of the magazine, the relatively egalitarian nature of the structure there, all of those are things. Fred Barnes's sort of very gruff, old-style newsman approach. Those were all things that really informed my views mm-hmm. about what it means to be a principled journalist who is in it for the truth, but also for the ideas.
You moved from the Weekly Standard to the New York Times, right?
That's right. I went to work for John Tierney at the New York Times. It was his debut as an op-ed columnist. He had never had the kind of latitude that that gig affords. And I, you know, it was all new to me, too. So it was a pretty fun experience to just go over to the New York Times and make everything up and hang out with John Tierney. That job was particularly fascinating to see, you know, particularly in 2018, we talk a lot about the mainstream media and, you know, the fake news and, you know, to have been on the inside of the New York Times and to see all the people operating in good faith there, but also the incredible power of the sort of social and class and political biases that were sort of easily evident going from the Weekly Standard to that newsroom. Mm-hmm. It was very instructive about
what were the big changes. I'm curious because I'm assuming, and I might be totally wrong, that a lot of the people at the Weekly Standard and the New York Times kind of went to the same schools. They came from similar backgrounds, but then they did comport themselves in very different ways. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the difference really did come down to the idea of objective journalism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to hold yourself every single day to what I see as an utterly impossible standard requires a kind of pretzeling of your self-conception and the conception of your mission that's very hard to sustain. And these were people who, in their day-to-day, they were looking, you know, they were looking for the next little fact, the next piece of information. You know, the sort of bread and butter of their work was very straightforward, but to be thoughtful and self-conscious about story selection and HR, mm-hmm. right? Like none of which I was exposed to. My official classification at the New York Times, I was a member of the union there, which was also instructive. And I was a clerk, right? Like I was like a tiny character in a Dickens novel. I was nobody. But to see even glimpses of how that functioned. And when I was there, they had just kind of debuted the idea of, you know, maybe we could have more than one. Bill Sapphire had just left. I actually had his phone number. So for a while I would get calls for Bill Sapphire, like, you know, be like, oh, you know, this is Paul Wolfowitz. Yeah. May I speak to Bill?
I need a one sentence definition of crepuscular or something.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? I would have been there for him. I would have been like, this I can handle. But, you know, David Brooks was there and Tierney was there. And I think it was the beginning of a thing that we're still seeing play out, you know, that we saw play out last month with the Kevin Williamson hiring and firing of mainstream publications, trying to figure out how to hire and talk to and talk about non-liberals in a non-stupid way. And I don't think they had quite mastered it then. And I don't think we've made a ton of progress today.
So after the Times, I think I know where this story leads.
Spoiler alert. Right. So my husband, then boyfriend, had gotten into business school. We were moving to Boston and I had lunch with you and said, hey, do you know anybody in Boston? Because I don't know what I'm going to do for the next 2 years. And at least as I remember it, you basically just said like, oh, well, you should just work for Reason. Yeah. Are you going to come back to D.C. sometime? And I was like, yeah, I think so. And you were like, OK, that's fine. And then I was hired. Is that a fair?
Yeah, that conversation I have a decent memory of. And, you know, it was one of the things at that point we were pretty dispersed and decentralized. Because I believe that, did we have the D.C. office at that point?
Going to open it. You knew that you were going to open a D.C. office. And so I think your one hesitation was, given that we're opening this D.C. office, should I be hiring people who are never going to work in it? And, you know, my answer of like, yeah, I'll probably be back was
And we could deal with that when we did. And you had written a couple of stories for us.
I had freelanced for y'all in between.
So there had been that kind of growth. One of the things that I'm always interested in talking about, and this started before I was management, but, you know, in the 90s, we started having people work remotely, and it turned out to be a very, you know, wise move. We were ahead of the curve in terms of letting people telecommute. And I was one of the first people to do it because my wife at the time had gotten an academic job. We were in LA. She got a job in Texas and we moved. And so I was very sympathetic and empathetic to people who were in academic ease. That's called you were the trailing spouse. And
that's
what do we do with the trailing spouse? You know, you don't have to do anything if they have a good job somewhere else. But
this is something that I think Reason has always been good at. I think to differing degrees of self-consciousness mm-hmm. and choice versus just necessity. But to sort of capture people who either for reasons of heterodox ideology, for reasons of heterodox personality or reasons of heterodox geography were not good candidates for employment at other publications and to sort of do some arbitrage on that and get just incredibly high quality journalists often for a fraction of the price, as they say in advertising. This idea that people that there are so many people who are incredibly talented writers, who are interesting thinkers, who are great reporters, who don't happen to be sitting right in the white hot center of the three places where we do journalism in this country, and to be just to take even a little bit of effort to find those people, of whom I think I am one on two, if not three, of those counts. To scoop them up and sort of bring them into the Reason fold and get the benefits of their talents.
On another kind of question of do we walk the walk, we talk the talk. Do we walk the walk? You are at least Reason's third female editor-in-chief in 50 years. Do you feel like, this is a larger question that is not specifically about Reason, it's more about libertarianism and feminism or gender issues. Do you feel that the libertarian movement or Reason as an organization does a good job of engaging women kind of making our worldview interesting, provocative, and essential to them?
So I have to say, when I was promoted to editor-in-chief, one of my favorite categories of interactions was people congratulating me on breaking the glass ceiling at Reason so that I could then say, actually, like, not only is the ceiling broken, but also, like,
it was a couple of men sweeping up the shards
Ago. Yeah. Exactly. So that's a real pleasure because, of course, it always does. It's great to sort of subvert expectations in that way. But the expectations exist for a reason. And, it's true that until very recently, and maybe still, there's a real gender imbalance in self-professed libertarians, in the United States. And I think that, one thing that I was actually talking about with an off the record group of women who shall not be named, but who might have been a newly formed book club last night, was whether or not the default person that society is built around is now female. Hmm. Right. So is it that for much, if not all of human history, in many, if not all human civilizations, the default person has been a man, or at least the person that we've done sort of theory about has been a man.
It's the portrait of the artist as a young man. Right. It isn't anymore.
And are we in a war on boys? Well, maybe it's just that the world that we're moving into looks a little bit more like, the cookie cutter person has on a skirt. Right. And what does that mean? And I think in many ways that is true. And I think that, the other kind of piece of that puzzle is that editors are helpers and people are more comfortable with women as helpers. And so I think female editors, magazine editors, is actually one of the very few jobs, high level jobs that women have already attained equality and have outpaced men, compared to almost any other top-level management or CEO-type job. Women have already taken over the managing magazine editor gig. And I think it is because, you know, we see the editor as helping the writer. We see the editor as, mm-hmm. you know, improving behind the scenes in some way. And I think that, you know, that is at least one explanatory factor at Reason as well as at other places. But yeah, there aren't enough libertarian women yet. My general feeling is that as we move into a world that I fully anticipate we are entering now, where some of the government institutions that take care of people break down, that may be an interesting moment for women who are still primary caretakers to think again about whether they want to rely on the state to perform those functions. And I may be saying this in part because I've just been like elbow deep in Zora Neale Hurston, who has some very stirring rhetoric, not only against the New Deal and the creation of dependency among blacks, but also I had not known this before. She wrote a letter to a newspaper opposing Brown versus mm-hmm. Board of Education,
yeah,
which was just an absolute rip roaring political rant of the highest degree.
And her main point in that, if I'm remembering correctly, is that it is deeply racist to say that blacks cannot learn amongst themselves.
Right. That basically, if people choose, you know, that free association dictates that people may choose to learn amongst their own kind, and that and she has this whole metaphor about the white mare leading the donkeys out of the paddock, and how dare you paint her as a donkey. I mean, right. It's really just stunning. So I am always skeptical of these, you know, these sort of the idea that women want the government to take care of them. I think there are plenty of women who know very well that asking anyone to take care of you is a foolish move. And I wonder if that'll become more apparent, you know, now that we've all got to eat cat food instead of paying for our prescriptions.
Yeah, well, now, you know, cat food is so much better. There are so many more flavors of it. You know,
so there's dry like salmon
and
cat
it's
food.
Like, Salmon is like garbage fish. I think there's, you know, Chilean sea bass pate that you can get.
God, I hope so. Yeah. We're gonna look this up after this podcast. I hope and believe that there is Chilean sea bass.
If there isn't, I'm already putting in a provisional patent. So back of the line. So you come back to Reason, and then you kind of took for yourself a beat, which was, you know, that you like to talk about as defending the indefensible. What were a couple of highlights of that, of your work, you know, when you were writing and editing for Reason prior to becoming editor-in-chief?
Yeah, I mean, I should note, of course, that defending the indefensible is a phrase not coined by me and already taken by Walter Block and others in the kind of Lou Rockwell end of the spectrum. So, you know.
And their indefensible stuff is probably stuff you're not going to spend a lot of time defending.
Yeah. But one thing that I found interesting, I think, which is related to this sort of story we were telling about my very first Reason article, which is, you know, something that people get wrong on the merits that plugs into bigger principles that they hold deeply and are unwilling to relinquish. And this, of course, is something I learned at the feet of John Tierney, who is most famous for his Recycling is Garbage article in the New York Times Magazine umpteen years ago, in which he looks at whether or not recycling is actually a net positive for the environment as practiced in New York at the time, and finds that the answer is no. And that article caused a massive outrage.
Yeah, I believe for a long time it had generated more mail and more feedback than any other Times piece in history.
That's right. And to sort of pick fights in that way, to sort of set out your turf, defend it, and then, you know, and then say, bring it on, you know, conventional wisdom is a model that I really appreciate and try to follow. So I wrote a piece two election cycles ago, maybe three, about why I don't vote and why most people probably shouldn't either, which is still has the singular power to derail any conversation that I am in. Like, just to casually, you know, that piece comes up or someone else mentions it, I never bring it up because, you know, it's there's a point where it's like, you know, I don't want to have this fight again. But I do think it's the Lord's work. So, you know, this idea that every vote counts is just on its face untrue, you know, in the sense of counts as influencing outcomes. The piece is very influenced by Brian Kaplan, who is, of course, the king of these sort of indefensible counterfactuals that are actually true. And then later, a piece about plastic bags, which was based partially on the work of Julian Morris, who's one of our colleagues here at the Reason Foundation, and then other work
was,
as well.
Yeah, what was the summarize the plastic bag argument? Because this is, you know, when we went through a spasm where, you know, plastic bags were the new Al-Qaeda. You know, we had to get rid of them everywhere we saw them because they were gumming up the works, literally and figuratively. So what's wrong with that?
There was this sort of hyper kind of conspicuous conscientiousness around reusable bags and this idea that that had gotten out there, again, a sort of quantitatively untrue idea that, you know, plastic bags were killing sea turtles by the millions and clogging our oceans and clogging our streams. And, you know, all of the research that I found, and I spent a lot of time digging into every avenue that I could locate. And it's just not true that plastic bags specifically are to blame. In the deep ocean, it's most often plastic debris from fishing or other industrial applications, as well as, you know, stuff that falls off of cargo containers. In urban areas, you know, there's often this idea of save the bay or save the, you know, the river. It's almost overwhelmingly true that the debris that clogs waterways around settled places is bottles and cans and paper, not plastic bags. And that turtles, you know, just have developed a taste for plastic bags over and above the jellyfish they favor.
The turtles have like a great PR firm.
Turtles have great PR.
Because people give a shit about turtles. And yet, you know, whenever you need one to change a flat tire, they're never around.
Never around. Never around.
You also, in that story, you talked about the marvel of technological innovation that is today's plastic shopping bag.
Right. So this was my beef, was like, people are using an antiquated technology. Like, the cloth bag is an old piece of tech. And this idea that we would prefer that to this incredible thing. Like, polypropylene is a masterwork of technological achievement. You basically take like four molecules and turn them into a bag. Like, it's mind blowing. And you can put a gallon of milk in that thing. It weighs nothing. It costs nothing to dispose of it. In fact, they are reusable. There was a tremendous culture of reuse around single use, quote unquote, single use plastic bags that are incredible. And I might have said the wrong thing. Polyethylene.
Yes.
And the idea that there's this sort of totally cost-free alternative was wrong, because people throw away these reusable bags. And when they wash them, it consumes energy. And when they don't wash them, they carry disease. And I just kind of got my guff up about the fact that people were talking smack about this incredible technological innovation because they were taking it for granted and taking for granted the science that had made it possible and the economic benefits, and so, you know, did this piece, and again, just a delightful response, including doing a television appearance where the people that I was debating were two small children and a sea turtle. So it's like, nothing can faze me after that. Like, bring it on. I will debate anyone.
You went from being a senior editor, an editor, a staff editor and writer. You became managing editor under Matt Welch, and then you became editor-in-chief. You have been editor-in-chief since when was your first print issue?
Sort of depends on when you count, but about a year ago, a little more.
Okay. And then also more recently, I mean, basically earlier this year, you actually became the first kind of consolidated head of Reason Journalism, without getting into too many details that aren't really relevant for most listeners. But you are now the editor-in-chief of the print magazine, of the website Reason.com, and of Reason TV, or Reason's Complete Journalism Division. What's your vision for Reason as a kind of multimedia platform? We're a full-blown media corporation at this point, having started out as an irregularly published mimeograph magazine in 1968. Have you come up with this, these magic words that will make everybody say, like, God damn it, I need to give more money to Reason and read more Reason and evangelize for Reason?
No pressure on that question.
Not at all.
That was good. I mean, I think the words were already there. And I think it's a huge benefit to me that as editor-in-chief, I have all of my ghosts of Christmas past just gathered around me all the time, right? I mean, I, of course, still have, you and Matt as editors at large, Bob Poole still active at the foundation, Marty Zupan here in D.C., and often accessible Virginia Postrel as a columnist in the print magazine and regular contributor. It's just an incredible, Manny Klausner still as a legal advisor to the Reason Foundation. It's an incredible piece of luck that I think almost any managing editor or any magazine editor would want of having all of this institutional knowledge, not just, theoretically accessible, but right there full time. And I think it's the magazine of free minds and free markets. Like, that motto is perfect and powerful. And one thing that I think about a lot is that I have everything I need to be a great editor and to put together a great magazine in the 50 years of Reason history. I mean, I think I could tell a story about how the magazine has evolved. And I'm sure that each step of the story, the person that I am characterizing would object to my characterization. But I think the evolution from the sort of college spitballing of Lanny Friedlander through the kind of, very objectivist inflected philosophical publication that it became, in the early days under Bob and Manny and Tibor, the policy wonkery, the just super intense attention to incremental gains for markets in the face of, overwhelming government interference, in particular that Bob Poole brings, this idea of how culture and how sort of culture eating politics, which, Marty and Virginia and you each have your own version of. And then also this vision from very, very early, going all the way back to Marty's tenure of and really arguably before, of Reason as doing investigative work, of bringing to bear serious journalism, quote unquote, serious journalism, as a way of both gaining credibility and arguing key points in a fresh way that, continues to be, I think, super important. And in fact, is something that we've been emphasizing more and more, while not neglecting the kind of, the morals of markets, like the underlying moral claim. I just think, like, all of that happens in a way at Reason that is also in the blood of the writers. We have so many people who have been here for such a long time, and you don't have to bring in a new person and sort of artificially construct, well, what does it mean to be a Reason article, or what are we even doing here, and what's our mission? So many people here know that answer so deeply and convey it in everything that they do and the way we talk about everything that it's not... it feels very natural. And I think it comes across in the magazine and the videos and the website and the podcasts that, for better or for worse, we are not confused about our goals. We are not confused about our mission. We know the world we want to see. How to get there, though, is so hard. And that's the part where I feel like Reason has always struggled and probably, always will struggle. Even though there are victories along the way, It's hard not to feel that you're fighting a losing battle.
Well, let me ask you about that. Do you, you know, and this is how old are you, if you don't mind my asking? And if you want to, you know, defer or whatever.
37.
Okay, so you're 37. So what's that mean? You were born in 1982?
1980.
Yeah, 1980. Jesus Christ. Wait, it's 2018.
Yep. So okay. My birthday hasn't happened yet this year.
All right. Well, you know, make sure you get an Amazon wish list going so that your fans can help out.
Journalists are not good at math.
Do
we
you?
See yet again.
Yeah, no, clearly. You know, financial journalists most of all. So do you feel like in your professional life so far, which is, you know, is a long time. I mean, you've been at this for close to 18 years or more than 18 years, really. Counting the internship, do you feel like capitalism is kind of growing, or is it under attack, or has it stayed about the same, or is that the wrong way to talk about things? Do you feel like libertarianism is kind of on the grow, or is it receding? Kind of like Rand Paul's presidential ambitions. Because part of what you're talking about here is, you know, reason does what it does, and then there's this larger climate of kind of similar magazines of ideas, of politics, of culture. Do you see capitalism, which is very important to us, does it matter more or less than it used to? Is it popular? Is it flailing?
Like many people my age, I have a certain amount of 90s nostalgia, and you can tell me whether or not this is true, but my sense is that there was a moment there right at the end of history when it really did feel like capitalism had won, or that the idea that we were sort of fundamentally going to be a trade and money oriented society rather than centralized economy oriented society, like that seemed to have that there was proof of concept there or something, that right. that the great battle had been waged and had been won. As I am thinking about, along with Stephanie Slade, the managing editor of the print magazine, how to put together our 50th anniversary issue, which will be the issue that's the last issue of this year in our 50th anniversary year. One thing that we've been talking about a lot is this phrase that we hear among younger people in particular that's been revived from its, I think, 60s and 70s origins of late stage capitalism or decadent capitalism.
I was afraid for a second you were going to say you wanted to immanentize the eschaton. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing
immanentize
that.
The eschaton. Yeah, yeah.
I think I know that, but
I do not want to immanentize the eschaton. Okay. I do want to think a lot about why people would think that. Why people would think that a world that in many ways is totally shaped by maximization of individualism, of choice, of trade, of movement across borders. I mean, certainly the world is more characterized by those things now than it has ever been. And in many ways, the competing ideas are more kind of enervated and weak than they have ever been.
Yeah, and this goes to the idea of, that whatever you could say about, 25 years ago, there were fewer actual communist countries than there were. Billions of people have been lifted out of poverty, first by the end of the Soviet Empire, but then even more importantly in recent years from extreme poverty through commercial trade. I mean, Bono, as well as the UN, all admit that it wasn't foreign aid, it was foreign trade that pulled billions of people out of poverty. So in that sense, it seems like capitalism is going pretty well, and there really isn't an alternative. There's a variation, which might be, the Danish model or something, but it's not the Soviet model versus the American model anymore. So
one question that you have to grapple with is, okay, there's that account of the major forces for good in the modern age. Then there's the kind of rights revolutions and the advent of a more expansive definition and implementation of the rule of law. And if that's what you see as the major developments of our age, and you think that there is still work to be done there, which I do, then another way to tell the same story is a story of the state, is a story of the state growing and protecting people who it had previously failed to protect in ways that are important both from each other, from corporate interests, and from other states, right? So I think that, you know, this is something that you get a lot when you read your Steven Pinkers and your sort of libertarian adjacent optimistic thinkers who are not necessarily going to filter everything through the lens of markets. Matt Ridley is less so, but who are still very sympathetic.
Yeah, but people who ridiculously still believe in things like public sidewalks.
Fools.
Yes.
Fools. Well, but the, you know, the idea of, well, what enabled the rights revolutions? And I feel very strongly and believe very strongly that what enabled the rights revolutions was not the growth of the state or even a differing conception of how the state should function, but the growth of wealth and the growth of connectivity, that by meeting people who turn out to be people, even though they are different than you in some demographic way, over the lines of, you know, media and telecommunications, that that's what expands the circle of humanity, and that to mistake that primarily as a phenomenon of the nation state is a tragic mistake, is a huge mistake.
So we shouldn't be giving credit to the Saudi Arabian government for finally letting women drive. It's more that wealthy women who are able to see, you know, or women in Saudi Arabia who are finally able to see how women everywhere else live, are kind of demanding and pushing for that, as are their allies, their male allies, who are also like, fuck, I don't want to have to drive everywhere.
That, and also that even if the Saudi state had not seen the light, or if it reverses those decisions, which it easily could, that the existence of Uber will still have a liberatory effect, and that the democratization of wealth will make solutions like Uber available to more people. Like, I think, you know, you don't need to privatize the postal service if you have email,
right,
is an argument that Reason has been making since there was email.
And since we've stopped making the argument about the
post office. Well, it's true. We've pretty much stopped the post office fight, although I do occasionally write about the just horrific accounting procedures that the Congress uses when it evaluates the U.S. Postal Service.
The post office, it's not its own worst enemy. It's, you know, sometimes it is, but Congress is certainly.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is actually the post office's own worst enemy. Like, she is the enemy of shutting down branches,
you know,
like none other.
This is a given, you know, that change comes last to the political sphere for a wide variety of reasons, including the fact that they, you know, they don't have to change because they get reelected, et cetera. But I will tell you, I just recently went and my younger son got his driver's license. And one of the reasons he took the test on Tuesday rather than Monday is that in the great state of Ohio, they don't do driving tests on Mondays. It's closed. And it's kind of like I realize this is a total digression, but it's like I was trying to explain to him the idea of banker's hours and like, did you know there was a time when you couldn't just get your money out of the bank if you wanted it? And like bankers,
and
you know, they
like,
worked like that
Dad,
too. And he was like,
don't
what?
Be crazy.
You know, what was that in like, you know, back in the black and white days? Et cetera. So,
I explained to my daughter recently about the idea of a mall, which kind of like blew her mind because she was like, well, but why would you like, you just get it on Amazon. Like she, like the difference between buying things and buying things on Amazon is a little bit lost to her.
So Ed, let me ask you, as long as we're talking about kids, what, you know, this used to be one of the things that libertarians were, you know, would even bring up. They'd be like, oh, well, you know, we don't really have a good theory of children or of families or anything. And now we live in an age where, you know, to the extent that people can kind of personalize and individualize their lives, it that probably doesn't have more meaning anywhere more than it does in terms of family structure, in terms of parenting styles, in terms of offerings for your kids. Do you see, you know, has the family become libertarianized? I'm not even sure what that means, but is that something that you see as a place where kind of libertarian values of autonomy, innovation, experimentation, just trying new stuff to see what happens? Is that a place where it's working, or is that a place that it shouldn't be applied? And like, you know, what we do is we take adults for granted and let them experiment, but not the way that you do stuff with your kids?
So I actually think that this is a good way to get at an important distinction, which is that I don't think that libertarianism has a theory of the family or that it needs one, right? So I think that the word libertarianism, to my mind, at least one way to grapple with it is to just say it's the question of what the state should and shouldn't do. And that's a complicated question, right? It's not just like, oh, privatize the roads.
Right.
There's, of course, like culture and society are very embedded in those questions. But I think reason should have a theory of the family, and that, you know, I certainly do, and that all those values that you just listed about individualization and autonomy and free expression and the theory of the family as the theory of the firm, like there's a bunch of things in there that have echoes and relevance to people who are trying to talk about the libertarian world as it could exist. But I do think it's valuable to sort of say, listen, libertarianism is a theory of when, if at all, you use state coercion and how to move from where we are to the place we want to be on that front. It has with it, though, a bunch of adjacent values, including aesthetic ones. And, you know, I think this is something that, you know, to sort of bring it full circle in this conversation, the thing that originally appealed to me about Rand was her totalizing philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. That she has an answer for everything. Like, do I like this music? Do I think this presidential candidate is good? Do yeah. I think this dress is attractive?
Yeah.
Do
hippies, I, you know, are astronauts? Did she ever get down to, like, you know, something like Winston cigarettes are good, Salem is garbage? I mean, did she take it down to that level?
In a slightly better world, like, Rand would have been a celebrity spokesman for brands on the grounds of, like, her objectivist philosophy, right? Like, we were so close. But that's ultimately not what I think we should look to our political philosophies for. And I think that's dangerous. And I do think it's something we can look to our magazines for. I am perfectly happy to provide an editorship that thinks about what Reason's answer is to do we celebrate or condemn families of choice as they exist in 2018? But I don't necessarily think that that's the same question as, you know, what does libertarianism tell us? And I think that that's the mistake that people make when they say libertarians don't have a theory of the family. Well, libertarians have a perfectly good couple of different competing theories about how we think about family structure relative to state power. But I don't think, quote unquote, libertarians need a theory of child rearing. Like, I love Lenore Skenazy, and I think everything she says is consistent with libertarianism. But I don't think every libertarian needs to have free range kids.
So you've heard it here first. Catherine Mangu Ward is for the actual imprisonment of children and ankle bracelets for all, but not provided by the state.
I would RFID chip my kids in a hot second if that wasn't socially unacceptable. I swear to God.
I don't think, you know, the thing about that is when you do that, and my kids are older than yours, just remember to have like a date or a way that you can turn the RFID chip off.
Oh, yeah, you need a,
and also,
you need a,
where they can't,
yeah, you need an expiration.
They can't reverse engineer it and find you after a certain point. You know, this relationship cuts both ways.
Well, I'm also going to RFID chip my editors at large. That's, you're okay with that, right?
Well, you know, how else would you know that we're at large, right? this leads to a nice introduction to the current issue, the burn after reading issue, which I have to say, you know, I've been with this organization in one way or another for, I think, 24, I'm coming up on like 25 years. So it's been a long time. This is absolutely one of my favorite issues. And, you know, in it, the burn after reading issue, which people can find a link on the page for this podcast. It'll show you how to get a copy of it if you're not an active subscriber. You can get a copy right away for very easily. But you lay out how to do a bunch of stuff that is illegal or illegal everywhere or in most parts of the state. including stuff like putting together a gun in your kitchen, making pot brownies, which would get you in big trouble in many states, how to get out of police custody if they tie you up with zip ties and things like that, how to make Pruno or prison booze. What was the impetus behind that, this collection of articles, and what does it say about the next 50 years of reason under your tutelage?
Everybody's going to be, drunk on prison hooch for the next 50 years.
Well, the ones who don't get botulism, right?
Right. So I actually do want to clarify, nearly everything that's in this issue is actually legal. It's just things that exist on the very, very borders of legality. So that gun, for instance, it's a homemade version of a Glock 17. It was built completely legally from parts that were purchased legally on the internet, and it is legal to possess it in some but not all states. And I think that's actually an important distinction, right? We didn't just give people, a bunch of funny tips about how to do stuff that's against the law. We really, and this was my goal with this issue, was to talk about where those fine lines of legality exist and whether they're in the right place. And I think that's something that we do all the time at Reason. But normally the way we talk about it is we go out in the world and we look at what other people are doing on those, in those borderlands, and we try to evaluate what's happening in the world. This was a sort of, okay, well, let's bring it home. And the origin of this issue truly was, in many ways, it was a gift of the D.C. office, which was being opened as I began at Reason. We were just hanging around in the kitchen, and we sort of started Googling, can you put tea? Like, what would a cannabis cocktail involve? One of our staffers, Mark McDaniel, was sort of saying, I saw you can buy these gun parts on the internet. We were just standing around shooting the shit. And this is, I think in some ways, this is, if you had asked 19-year-old Catherine when she was interning for Reason Magazine, what would it be like? Like, what would it be like if you were the editor of Reason Magazine in the future? This is exactly what I would imagine and hope for. This sort of collaborative investigation into stuff that's a core part of our mission, but also fun and weird and journalistically interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we sent people off their normal beats a little bit. Mike Riggs writing about growing mushrooms and Liz Nolan Brown talking about how to encode your text messages or encrypt your text messages so that you can have private communications. And I think,
and then Declan McCullough on the other side of the country, a contributor, talking about how you can spy on your partners who are trying to encrypt their text messages.
Or protect yourself from a spying partner if you are on the other end of that coin. So I think there's a bunch of things in this issue that are, they were meant to push our own boundaries and to go someplace. Like, I am not a gun owner. I would not build a gun in my kitchen. I certainly would not fire a gun that I personally built. But I think it's a thing that's important to Reason, and it's a thing that's important to the future of freedom in the United States to talk about where technology and Second Amendment rights intersect and how prohibitions mm-hmm. work in the world that we live in. So,
and it's broader than that, too, right? I mean, it's a whole kind of do-it-yourself DIY ethic of, guns, certainly, but also drugs and self-improvement and communications and family life and gender. And, it's all DIY, right? I mean, that's
right.
a big part of the libertarian or Reason's libertarian sensibility, it seems to me, of like, let's go into the garage. I mean, we had our longtime science correspondent, Ron Bailey, doing God knows what with a CRISPR gene editing kit. And this is a guy who, Ron, I love you, but who has trouble italicizing words online using a text editor.
He made antibiotic resistant E. coli. So watch out, world. Yeah, I mean, I think, the other point of this issue was to start conversations. And, one thing that I think about a lot, and I know that you have thought and written about a lot, is, what does it mean to live in a world that's much more libertarian in some sense, or much freer or more affording of individual choice, when people don't realize how much the world has changed, when they sort of take for granted each step in the direction of autonomy? So much so that they can't even tell a story of what the world looked like before they had those options. And, you know, in my professional life, obviously, I'm one of many libertarians. But in my, you know, in many of my personal circles, I'm the token libertarian. And one thing that's been really fun about this issue is talking to people about it and the ways in which stuff that was an absolute pipe dream, even at the beginning of your editorship, is now taken for granted by the, you know, god-awful rich white people that I hang out with in coastal elite enclaves, you know, including I made a couple of batches of pot brownies for this issue trying to get the recipe perfect. And, you know, I started taking them to dinner parties instead of bottles of wine. And they were universally accepted with delight. And, you know, that is a world that we did not live in until quite recently. And I live in Washington, D.C., where it's legal to share but not to buy marijuana, which makes a gift of pot brownies especially welcome. But, you know, I think that kind of thing. And also when I'm talking about in this issue, the article about how to hire an escort written by a sex worker, and people sort of find it to be charming and slightly offbeat, but not horrifying and illegal and deeply troubling, as I think they easily might have done in a very similar social circle 20 years before. It's a good exercise in sort of testing the public's tolerance for certain types of ideas and rubrics that reason has been pushing for 50 years.
That is, it is fascinating. You forget. I mean, I guess, you know, everybody, not just generals, are fighting the last war. And I can remember reading stuff by, you know, Hayek and Mises in the 60s or long after this had ceased to be a debate, where they would be talking about how, you know, in the early 20th century, people would say, unless you had a government kind of dictating what goods were made and where they were sold, like nothing would be on supermarket shelves. And, you know, that argument just isn't necessary to make anymore because we've gotten, you know, we're past that point. We have different arguments to have about, you know, controlling and regulating, supermarket goods or something, but it's not whether or not they would exist. And it's also true that in many social situations, things that might have seemed a little bit sketchy or freaky just a few years ago now are totally accepted. Can I ask, and maybe as a, as a kind of closing conversation, you know, so let's assume, I don't do math, but I'm pretty sure 50 years from now will be 2068. How would you, from a kind of reasoned libertarian perspective, how would you, what's the yardstick that you use to say, okay, freedom has expanded and it's been good? How would we know if some of the things you were mentioning, and I'm listening to in my head, people saying like, yeah, that's exactly right. Pot brownies are legal now and it's a worse world for that. Buying sex is legal now or is accepted now, and it's a worse world. All sorts of kind of arguments against, libertarian values winning. Is there a way that we would be able to say, you know what, the world has gotten too libertarian its own good?
I am possibly just because of so many years hanging around with or imbibing the thought of Ron Bailey. I really do believe that the world 50 years from now will be completely unrecognizable. I think it is true that the pace of change is accelerating. I think it's quite likely that we're at some kind of inflection point in terms of artificial intelligence, in terms of biotech. And this is something that I think libertarians and economists in particular have always been better at than others, which is to say, I don't know what it's going to look like. I mean, this is something that as a fan of science fiction, I'm always struck by how wrong everyone gets it. And one reason that almost any book that's set in 2018 or thereabouts or movie that's set in 2018 or thereabouts gets it so wrong is because no one saw the internet. Besides Neil Stephenson, greatest hero of our time. And I think there's going to be another internet at least, and probably 100 more internets in the next 50 years. I genuinely believe that. And so I think, you know, this is, of course, Virginia Postrel's influence on me as well, the idea of trying to think about the world as a dynamic system, trying to think about what elements of our current stasis we're taking for granted that might erode at any time. So I can't answer that question on principle. And I think, you know, when we talk about, well, what does the world look like when the drug war really ends? We don't know. And what does the world look like when the healthcare market looks a teeny bit more like a market, much less a truly free market? We don't know. And Milton Friedman, you know, was comfortable with saying that quite regularly. I can make guesses about what the market will provide.
But he can do that while polishing his Nobel Prize, right?
You know,
it's a lot easier for him.
And so shall I 50 years from now, Nick. There's my prediction.
Okay. So there will be a Nobel Prize for editing.
And I will be the last human. Yeah. I'll be the last human to receive
that
it.
That sounds so lonely. I don't know. Maybe, but then again, you get a lot of party invites, right? Which is why you got into this business in the first place.
As you know, I welcome our robot overlords.
Well, we will leave it there. Catherine Mangu Ward, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you for talking with me. This has been fun. And thank you for creating the Reason magazine that you were so gracious as to hand off to me.
Well, I don't know. Certainly, I am merely a handmaid or hand mister. I don't know. You know, whatever. I'm a link in a chain, baby.
Hand mister is
hand
the
mister.
Best.
The hand mister's tale, I think, sounds like that's the porn version of the Handmaid's Tale.
We are all hand misters for the future for progeny of Reason.
Yes. Well, we've been talking about Reason's first 50 years, its next 50 years, and we've been talking about that with its current editor-in-chief of Reason's journalism, Catherine Mangu Ward. This has been the Reason Podcast. I remain your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.